scandals in modern times. We honour André in every sentence. In his report, Mikael Blomqvist writes, André believed in love. He believed in a better world and a more just society. He was the best of us. The report ran to more than 30 pages of the magazine and was perhaps the best piece of journalistic prose Grana had ever read. She sometimes had tears in her eyes, but still smiled when she came to the words, "Seppo's star analyst, Gabriele Grana, demonstrated outstanding civic courage." The basic story was simple. A group of individuals under Commander Johnny Ingram, who ranked just below the NSA head, Admiral Charles O'Connor, and had close contacts with the White House and Congress, had begun to exploit the vast numbers of trade secrets in the hands of the organization for their own gain. He had been assisted by a group of business intelligence analysts at Solifon's research department, Y. If the matter had stopped there, it would have been a scandal which was in some way comprehensible. But the course of events followed its own evil logic when a criminal group, the Spiders, entered the drama. Mikael Blomqvist had evidence to show how Johnny Ingram had gotten together with the notorious Russian Duma member Ivan Gribanov and Faust, the mysterious leader of the Spiders, to plunder tech companies of ideas and new technology with astronomical sums of money, and to sell it all. But they really plumbed the depths of moral depravity when Professor Franz Balder picked up their tracks and it was decided to eliminate him. That was the most astonishing part of the story. One of the most senior executives of the NSA had known that a leading Swedish researcher was going to be murdered, and did not lift a finger to prevent it. It was not the account of the political quagmire that most engaged Grana, but rather the human drama. There Blomqvist's gifts as a writer were on full display. She shuddered at the creeping realization that we live in a twisted world where everything, both big and small, is subject to surveillance, and where anything worth money will always be exploited. Just as she finished reading, she noticed someone standing in the doorway. It was Helena Kraft, beautifully dressed, as always. Grana could not help remembering how she had suspected Kraft of being the leak in the investigation. What she had taken to be guilty shame had been Kraft's regret at the unprofessional way in which the investigation was being conducted. At least that is what she had been told during their long conversation, after Morten Nielsen confessed and was arrested.
"I can't begin to say how sorry I am to see you go," Kraft said.
"Everything has its time."
"Do you have any idea what you're going to do?"
"I'm moving to New York. I want to work in human rights, and as you know, I've had an offer on the table from the UN for some time."
"It's a loss for us, Gabriella, but you deserve it."
"So my betrayal's been forgiven?"
"Not by all of us, I can assure you, but I see it as a sign of your good character."
"Thanks, Helena.
Will I see you later at the Pressklubben's memorial for André Zander? First, I have to do a presentation for the government on this whole mess. But later this evening I'll raise a glass to young Zander, and to you, Gabriella."
Alona Casales was sitting at a distance, contemplating the panic with an inward smile. She observed Admiral O'Connor crossing the floor, looking like a bullied schoolboy, rather than the head of the world's most powerful intelligence organization. But then all the powerful figures at the NSA were feeling pathetic today. All except Needham. Needham was not in a good mood, either. He waved his arms around and was sweaty and bilious, but he exuded all his usual authority. It was obvious that even O'Connor was afraid of him. Needham had come back from Stockholm with real dynamite, had caused a huge argument, and insisted on a complete shake-up throughout the organization. The head of the NSA was not going to thank him for that. He probably felt like sending Needham to Siberia immediately and forever. But there was nothing he could do. He looked small as he approached Needham, who did not even bother to turn in his direction. Needham ignored the head of the NSA in the same way he ignored all the other poor bastards he had no time for, and plainly nothing improved for O'Connor once the conversation got going. For the most part, Needham seemed dismissive, and even though Casales could not overhear, she could imagine what was being said, or rather, what was not being said. Over the course of her own long conversations with Needham, he refused to say one word about the way he got hold of the information. He was not going to compromise on a single point.
and she respected that. Needham seemed determined to milk the situation for all it was worth, and Casales solemnly swore that she would stand up for integrity in the agency and give Needham as much backing as she could if he ran into any problems. She also swore to herself that she would call Gabriella Grana in a final bid to ask her out, if rumours were true that she was on her way over here. Needham was not, in fact, deliberately ignoring the NSA head, but neither was he going to interrupt what he was doing, yelling at two of his controllers, just because the Admiral was standing at his desk. Only after about a minute did he address him, and then, in fact, he said something friendly, not to ingratiate himself or compensate for his nonchalance, but because he really meant it.
"You did a good job at the press conference."
"Did I?" said the Admiral.
"It was hell." "Well, you can thank me, then, for giving you time to prepare."
"Thank you? Are you kidding? Every news site around the world is posting pictures of Ingram and me together. I'm guilty by association."
"In that case, for Christ's sake, keep your own people in line from now on."
"How dare you talk to me like that?"
"I'll talk however the hell I want. We're in the middle of a crisis, and I'm responsible for security. I don't get paid for being polite."
"Watch what you say," O'Connor began. But he was thrown when Needham suddenly stood up, big as a bear, either to stretch his back or assert his authority.
"I sent you to Sweden to clean all this up," the Admiral went on. "Instead, when you came back, everything was a complete disaster."
"The disaster had already happened," Needham snapped. "You know it as well as I do."
"So how do you explain all the shit that ended up in that Swedish magazine?"
"I explained it to you 1,000 times.
"Right, you're hacker. Guesswork and bullshit."
Needham had promised to keep Wasp out of this mess, and it was a promise he meant to keep.
"Top quality bullshit, don't you think?" he said. "That damn hacker, whoever he may be, must have cracked Ingram's files and leaked them to Millennium. That's bad, I agree. But do you know what's worse? What's worse is that we had the chance to cut the hacker's balls off and put an end to the leaking. Instead, we were ordered to shut down our investigation. Let's not pretend you went out of your way to stand up for me then."
"I sent you to Stockholm."
"But you called off my guys, and our entire investigation came to a grinding halt. Now the trail is cold, and how much good would it do us if it came out that some lousy little hacker had taken us for a ride?"
"Not much, probably. But we can still make trouble for Millennium and that reporter, Blomstrom, believe you me."
"It's Blomqvist, actually. Mikael Blomqvist. Be my guest. You'd win a lot of popularity contests if you marched in on Swedish territory and arrested the world's most celebrated journalist right about now," Needham said.
The Admiral muttered something inaudible and stormed off. Needham knew as well as anyone that O'Connor was fighting for political survival and could not afford to make any reckless moves. He himself was fed up with working his fingers to the bone, and he loped over to Casales to chat with her instead. He was in the mood for something irresponsible.
"Let's go get hammered, and forget this whole fucking mess."
Anna Boldo was standing on the little hill outside Hotel Schloss Elmau in her snow boots. She gave August a push, and watched him whiz down the slope on the old-fashioned wooden toboggan the hotel had lent them. He came to a stop, near a brown barn. Even though there was a glimmer of sunshine, a light snow was falling. There was hardly any wind. In the distance, the mountain peaks touched the sky, and wide-open spaces stretched out before her. Anna had never stayed in such a wonderful place, and August was recovering well, not least thanks to Charles Edelman's efforts. But none of it was easy. She felt terrible. Even here on the slope she had stopped twice and felt her chest. Withdrawal from her pills, benzodiazepines, was worse than she could have imagined. At night she would lie in bed, curled up like a shrimp, and examine her life in the most unsparing light, sometimes banging her fist against the wall and crying. She cursed Lasse Westman, and she cursed herself. And yet, there were times when she felt strangely purified, and occasionally she came close to being happy. There were moments when August would work quietly on his equations and his number series, and would even answer her questions, albeit in monosyllables and somewhat odd terms. The boy was still an enigma to her, Sometimes he spoke in numbers, in high numbers, to the power of even higher numbers, and seemed to think that she would understand. But something had changed. She would never forget how she had seen August sitting at the desk in their hotel room that first day, writing out long, winding equations which poured from him with amazing fluency, and which she photographed and sent on to the woman in Stockholm. Late that evening, a text message had come in on Hannah's black phone. "Tell August we've cracked the code." She had never seen her son so happy and proud. Even though she had no idea what it was all about, and never mentioned it even to Charles Edelman, it meant the world to her. She began to feel proud, too. Immeasurably proud. She developed a passionate interest in savant syndrome, and when Charles was staying at the hotel, they often sat up after August had gone to bed and talked into the small hours about her son's abilities, and about everything else, too. She was not sure it had been such a good idea to jump into bed with Charles. Yet she was not sure it had been a bad idea, either. Charles reminded her of France. They formed a little family of sorts. She, August, Charles, the rather strict but kind teacher, Charlotte Greber, and the Danish mathematician, Jens Nierup, who visited them. Their whole stay was a voyage of discovery into her son's remarkable universe. As she now sauntered down the snowy hill, and August got up from the toboggan, she felt, for the first time in ages, she would become a better mother, and she would sort out her life. Blomqvist could not understand why his body felt so heavy. It was as if he were trying to move through water. And yet there was a commotion going on out there, a victory celebration. Nearly every newspaper, website, radio station, and TV channel wanted to interview him. He did not accept any of the requests. When Millennium had published big news stories in the past, he and Berrier had not been sure whether other media companies would latch on to them. They had needed to think strategically, make sure they were syndicated in the right places, and sometimes even share their scoop. Now none of that was necessary. The news broke with a bang all by itself. When NSA head Charles O'Connor and U.S. Secretary of Commerce Stella Parker appeared at a joint press conference to apologize publicly for what had happened, the last lingering doubts about the story's credibility were dispelled. Now a heated debate was raging on editorial pages around the world about the consequences and implications of the disclosures. But in spite of all the fuss and the telephones which never stopped ringing, Berrier had decided to arrange a last-minute party at the office. She felt they deserved to escape from the hullabaloo for a little while and raise a glass or two. A first print run of 50,000 copies had sold out the previous morning, and the number of hits on their website, which also had an English version, had reached several million. Offers of book contracts poured in, their subscription base was growing by the minute, and advertisers were lining up. They had also bought out Cerner Media. Berrier had managed to push the deal through a few days earlier, though it had been anything but easy. Cerner's representatives had sensed her desperation and taken full advantage, and for a while she and Blomqvist had thought that it would prove impossible. Only at the 11th hour, when a substantial contribution came in from an unknown company in Gibraltar, bringing a smile to Blomqvist's face, had they been able to buy out the Norwegians. The price had been outrageously high, given the situation, but it was still a minor coup when a day later the magazine's scoop was published and the market value of the Millennium brand rocketed. They were free and independent again, though they had hardly had time to enjoy it. Journalists and photographers had even hounded them during Zander's memorial at Pressklubben. Without exception, they had wanted to offer congratulations, but Blomqvist felt smothered, and his responses had not been as gracious as he would have liked them to be. The sleepless nights and headaches continued to plague him. Now, in the late afternoon of the following day, the furniture in the office had been hurriedly rearranged. Champagne, wine, beer, and catered Japanese food had been set out on the desks, and people started to stream in, first the staff and freelancers, then a number of friends of the magazine, not least Holger Palmgren. Mikael helped him out of the lift, and the two embraced.
"Our girl made it,"
said Palmgren, with tears in his eyes.
"She generally does," Blomqvist replied with a smile.
He installed Palmgren in the place of honour on the sofa and gave orders that his glass was to be kept filled. It was good to see him there. It was good to see all sorts of old and new friends.
Gabriele Grana was there too, and Chief Inspector Bublansky, who should probably not have been invited, in view of their professional relationship and Millennium's status as independent watchdog over the police force. But Blomqvist had wanted to include him. Officer Bubble spent the whole evening talking to Professor Farah Sharif. Blomqvist drank a toast with them and the others. He was wearing jeans and his best jacket, and, unusual for him, he had quite a lot to drink. But he could not shake off that empty, leaden feeling, and that was because of Xander, of course. Andrei was constantly in his thoughts. The moment in the office when his colleague had so nearly taken up his offer of a beer was etched in his mind, a moment both humdrum and life-determining. Memories of the young man flashed up all the time, and Blomqvist had difficulty concentrating on conversations. He had had enough praise and flattery. The only tribute that did affect him was Pernilla's text, "You do write for real, Papa." And occasionally he glanced over towards the door. Naturally, Lisbeth Salander had been invited, and would have been the guest of honour had she turned up. Blomqvist had wanted to thank her for the handsome contribution during the Serna dispute, but there was no sign of her. What did he expect? Her sensational, decrypted document had allowed him to unravel the whole story, and had even persuaded Needham and the head of Solifon, Nicholas Grant, to give him more details. But he had heard from Salander only once since then, when he had interviewed her, to the extent that was possible, over the Redphone app, about what had happened out at the summer house on Ingaru. That was a week ago now, and Blomqvist had no idea what she thought of his article. Maybe she was angry that he had dramatized it. He had no choice but to fill in the blanks around the meagre answers she gave. Or perhaps she was furious because he had not mentioned Camilla by name, but had simply referred to her as a Swedish-Russian woman known as Thanos. Or else she was disappointed that he had not taken a harder line across the board. It was impossible to know. The situation was not improved by the fact that Chief Prosecutor Ekstrom really did appear to be considering a case against Salander. Unlawful deprivation of liberty and seizure of property were the charges he had cooked up. Eventually Blomqvist got fed up with it all and left the party without saying goodbye. The weather was awful, and for lack of anything better to do, he scrolled through his text messages. There were congratulations and requests for interviews and a couple of indecent proposals. But nothing from Salander. He switched off his mobile and trudged home with surprisingly heavy steps for a man who had just pulled off the scoop of the century. Salander was sitting on her red sofa on Fiskargatan, gazing emptily out at Gamlestan and Ritterfjärden. It was a little over a year since she had started the hunt for her sister and her father's criminal legacy, and there was no denying her success on many counts. She had tracked down Camilla and dealt the spiders a serious blow. The connections with Solifon and the NSA had been severed. Ivan Gribanov, the Duma member, was coming under tremendous pressure in Moscow. Camilla's hitman was dead, and her closest henchmen, Yuri Bogdanov and several other computer engineers, were wanted by the police, forced to go underground. But Camilla was alive, somewhere out there. Nothing was over. Salander had only winged her quarry, and that was not enough. Grimly she looked down at the coffee table, where a packet of cigarettes and her unread copy of Millennium lay. She picked up the magazine and put it down again. Then she picked it up once more, and read Blomqvist's report. When she reached the last sentence, she stared for a while at the new photograph next to his byline. Then she jumped to her feet and went to the bathroom to put on some makeup. She pulled on a tight black T-shirt and a leather jacket and went out into the December evening. She was freezing. It was crazy to be wearing so little. But she did not care. She cut down towards Maria Toriot with quick steps, turned left into Svedensborgsgatan, and walked into a restaurant called Sud, where she sat down at the bar and alternated between whiskey and beer. Since much of the clientele came from the world of culture and journalism, it was hardly surprising that many of them recognized her. Guitarist Johan Norberg, for example, who wrote a regular column for V, and was known for picking up on small yet significant details, observed that Salander was not drinking as if she enjoyed it, but rather as if she had to get it out of the way. There was something determined about her body language, and a cognitive behavioral therapist who happened to be sitting at a table nearby wondered if Salander was even aware of anyone else in the restaurant. She hardly looked around the room, and seemed to be preparing herself for some kind of operation or action. At 9:15 she paid in cash and stepped into the night, without a word or gesture. Despite the cold, Blomqvist walked home slowly, deep in gloom. A smile only crossed his lips when he ran into some of the regulars outside the Bishop's Arms.
"So you weren't washed up after all?"
Arne, or whatever his name was, bellowed.
"Maybe not quite yet," Blomqvist replied.
For a moment he considered having a last beer inside and chatting with Amir. But he felt too miserable. He wanted to be alone, so he continued to the entrance door of his building. On the way up the stairs he was overcome by a vague sense of unease, maybe as a result of all that he had been through. He tried to dismiss it, but it would not go away, especially when he realized that a light had blown on the top floor. It was pitch black up there. He slowed his steps and sensed a movement. There was a flicker, a weak sliver of light as if from a mobile, and a figure like a ghost, a slight person with dark, flashing eyes, could be made out.
"Who's that?"
he said, frightened. Then he saw it was Salander. He brightened at first and opened his arms, but she looked furious. Her eyes were rimmed with black, and her body seemed coiled, as if prepared for an attack.
"Are you angry with me?"
he said. "Quite."
"Why is that?"
Salander took a step forward, her face shining and pale, and he remembered her gunshot wound.
"Because I come to visit, and there's no one at home," she said.
He walked towards her.
"That's a bit of a scandal, isn't it?"
he said.
"I'd say so."
"What if I ask you in now?"
"Then I suppose I'll have to accept."
"In that case, welcome," he said.
And for the first time in ages, a broad smile spread across his face. A star fell outside in the night sky. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Girl in the Spider's Web by David Lagercrantz, translated from the Swedish by George Golding. Executive producer Aaron Blank. Translation copyright 2015 by George Golding. Originally published in Sweden as Det som inte dödar oss by Norstedts Stockholm in 2015. Copyright 2015 by Norstedts Agency. This translation, simultaneously published in Great Britain by Maclehose Press, an imprint of Quercus, London, with agreement of Norstedts Agency. Published by arrangement with Quercus Publishing PLC, UK. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.